welcome to the Southern Fried Security Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Sicoli, and tonight I am joined by the only person who is a friend on my Apple Watch, Mr. Guillaume Ross. Guillaume, how are you doing tonight?
Doing pretty great, you?
Doing pretty well. Guillaume was kind enough to join in. Steve is still recovering from DerbyCon. Apparently there was an incident with some bourbon and a bowler hat. I'm not sure what happened there, but he's taking some time to recover for the evening. Yvette is, I believe, fixing all of the problems of PCI somewhere in Vancouver. And then Andy and Martin are who knows where. But Guillaume was kind enough to jump on tonight because, let's face it, Guillaume, if you're on, something Apple-related happened, and you're the guy I go to when it comes time to talk Apple and security stuff. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago, tonight is Monday, September 28th, and a couple of weeks ago, iOS 9 came out. And as part of that, Apple included some interesting privacy and security features. The one that has brought the most hullabaloo is the opening up on the App Store of content blockers. And content blockers are kind of what Apple is really calling an ad blocker. You know, let's call it really what it is. It's blocking advertisement, particularly by blocking scripts and things like that. And there's kind of been a whole hullabaloo because, you know, this has brought back that old discussion of, well, if you're blocking ads, how are you supporting publishers and things like that online? And I don't really want to get into that here. That's a discussion. I think the best one I have heard so far is over on the Back to Work podcast, episode number 239. They got into kind of some of the morality and stuff around content blocking and things like that. And I'll make sure I'll put a link in the show notes to that episode. So if you want to go talk about or hear people talk about the ethics and things of content blocking, you can go there. But Guillaume, what I really wanted to talk to you particularly about tonight, because you've been vocal on Twitter about these content blockers. You know, I kind of wanted to get like a privacy and security perspective on these ad blockers, because while a lot of people are talking about the impact it has on advertising revenue and things along those lines, we in the security field have a slightly different opinion on them. And I think it's kind of important to look at these as part of your security strategy for browsing the web. Would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely do. And in fact, you know, the being called content blocker and not ad blocker is actually from the perspective of Apple and the features that they made available is technically correct, right? Because there's a few things in iOS that you couldn't do before. So for example, if you wanted to filter any type of content, let's say you have a bunch of iOS devices in a school, you really had to rely on network controls. If you wanted to block, you know, some website categories or any kind of content like that. But when the kids would go home, then, you know, there's no network controls unless you force them to VPN back in. So that brought a lot of complexity. So now we made those features available. A lot of ad blockers are out that use those new features in iOS 9, because it's worth mentioning that iOS 9 by itself will not block any advertisement. You still have to, you know, go look for it and download one. And even just enabling one is not that straightforward. So I don't think it's going to be like 100% of the people who are going to do that. Is it going to be as much as on PC? Maybe, or maybe a little bit less. Who knows? I guess we'll know more about that. So they're content blockers. Eventually, we're probably going to see some different types of content blockers. And what's always been interesting to me is that some people have been very vocal about you know, ad blocking, and you've seen, you know, websites like The Verge post, you know, articles. Neelay Patel posted this big article about how much the web sucked on mobile, which I thought was pretty ironic considering that The Verge probably requires like 16 terabytes of RAM to load on a mobile device if you don't have ad blocking enabled. So that was a first article a few weeks ago that was out, which, you know, there's some good points in there. But at the same time, you know, when you're posting that from The Verge, it's kind of ironic. And then you've had people like John Gruber at Daring Fireball saying, you know, yes, the web does suck. Look at all these crazy super fat websites, you know, a bunch of trackers and everything. It's super bad, and kind of making fun of The Verge, and then saying things like your ad blocker should never block the deck, which is the advertising network that they use, because basically it's good. And at the time, you know, everyone was discussing all these new content blockers and these networks and all of that. Some people started trying to make a big difference between this is an ad blocker and this is a tracker blocker. You know, we don't want to block the good ads. We just want to block the trackers. And then that got me into thinking, like, what's the difference between a tracker and an ad that's loaded on a server that's a different server than the one serving you the web page you're on? You know, mostly people will say, well, the tracker is going to have cookies. Sometimes the trackers are going to have, you know, third-party JavaScript embedded in them. But the truth is, even if you're just loading an image from an ad network, you know, just a straight image, your IP address, the information from, you know, your user agent string, everything that's in your browser headers, that's a lot of information that, you know, they could still track you pretty easily with just that information. So to me, the line between what's a tracker and what's an ad network, it's not that clear to me. I mean, if I'm hitting a resource that's on a different server, that's going to be able to see my IP address and some information about my browser while I browse, let's say, Soldered Fried Security Podcast's website, and then I go on someone else's website and they're using the same ad network, well, they're going to know I was on these two websites pretty easily. So that is some kind of tracking. So first of all, that's it's not a super clean line. And I thought, you know, there's been some hypocrisy as well. You know, you should block the bad stuff, but you should block my stuff because it's good. But then that good stuff, air quotes, doesn't have a privacy policy. There's no one on that website explaining what they do with logs or anything like that. So it's just like, take my word for it. My network is good. You shouldn't be blocking that. And that was also already pretty interesting. But then what I found more interesting was when all the ad blockers started getting released for iOS 9. You know, I tried a few. by a few, I mean, you know, probably every single one of them that was in the store. And I was mostly interested in seeing, you know, which one has a good list to start with, which one has any interesting feature, how fast are they. You know, I didn't do any kind of actual scientific testing because I figured, you know, someone else would, and, you know, why not be lazy and just, you know, read someone's content for free if I could. But then what I noticed was a very different type of ad blocking experience and what the model is that they would use behind them. So, for example, you have blockers like One Blocker, which is extremely granular. You know, you can do pretty much anything in there. If you just like hated the blink tag and it still worked in your browser, you could just go and write, you know, some kind of regular expression for it and just block that. And it comes with this super granular list. You can basically block anything that you want, but it's more for power users. But then you have a bunch of them with just like on off, or block ads and then block, I don't know, block comments on websites or block media if you want to save on bandwidth or whatever. And what I found pretty interesting, it was that in that some of those, I could see that there's a whitelist. There were actually some ad networks that were whitelisted just because the person that made that content blocker liked that ad network. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit. I don't want to name names, but that was pretty much it. You know, we're not blocking that because we like those guys. And so I asked, you know, is it because of a privacy policy? Is it because they say they don't track? Is it because there's no JavaScript? And nope, it's just because we like them. And eventually you might have the option of disabling that whitelist. So already that was pretty interesting. Then we saw, I think it's Crystal, which was free on launch and then was paid. And now they're introducing, you know, like a paid whitelist. You just pay them to be in their whitelist, which I found to be a little weird, you know.
That's pretty gross.
and that's not something that's been, like, it's not like it hasn't happened on PC, right? The whole, was it AdBlock or AdBlock Plus? I always AdBlock confuse. AdBlock
Plus, I believe. So it whitelists things like Reddit and a handful of other sites that meet an acceptable use policy or an acceptable ads policy.
Yeah, which, there's the acceptable ads, and then, you know, if they end up having to pay for that, then that just makes it, you know, even weirder. So the way I see it, you know, if I want to whitelist a website, you know, and ads that they use, that's fine. I can do that. I've done that in the past on websites where, you know, the ads were actually interesting and did not slow down the loading of the page. I've done that in the past, but for someone who makes a tool that is actually sold on the App Store, like I know it's like stupid amounts of money. It's like $1 or $3 or whatever. It's not like it's a big amount of money, but just the principle. If I'm going to pay for a content blocker and you have your own whitelist, I should at least be able to see that whitelist and then manually delete things in there. So, and I think what was even more interesting was that in some cases, the whitelist was a network that's very popular on, you know, blogging, like Apple-related blogging websites. So that just makes it even weirder. Like, are you trying to be featured on these websites and that's why you're trying to be nice to them? Like, I don't think so. I don't think it was malicious in any way, but it's just no one seems to have thought that if you're going to have a whitelist in there, you should have, like, criteria on your website. Like, say, okay, web, like, ad network, ABC, we have them in the whitelist by default because, and then say, they do not accept any JavaScript from third parties. Here's what they say they do with the logs. Here's their privacy policy. And because of all these different reasons, that's why they're in a whitelist. That would be, I think that would be great. I think that would be a super good idea. But just, you know, we randomly, or not randomly, but we just decide what we put in there for, you know, no specific reason other than we like them. I don't think that's a good idea. And I even think that, you know, from a legal perspective, I think it's going to be interesting. Like, what if you have an ad blocker, it becomes super popular, like millions of people install it. Let's just say everyone who's got iOS just installs your ad blocker.
Right.
And then you like my blog and you decide that the ad network that I use is going to be whitelisted. But then there's another ad network that competes, similar websites. They have the same privacy policy. They deliver the same type of ads. That would even seem weird. Like, if I was making an ad blocker, I would not feel good being, like, the one making those decisions, right? Like, would you want to be the one deciding who gets to display their ads that they're going to make money from? Or would you just want to say, we block everything? Everything that we know of, we block it, and the user can whitelist. Like, what would you do if you were making an ad blocker?
Well, and I think that kind of gets down to, like, the situation that Marco Arment found himself in after the release of his ad blocker piece, I believe it is. And I'll toss, he has a really good explanation of kind of that situation in Accidental Tech Podcast. What episode is that? 136.
But then, I mean, he had outsourced the list. Yeah. He was just using the list from Ghostery. And then he points out to things like his app wasn't granular enough yet. People couldn't whitelist specific websites or you know, all the control that you have with the real Ghostery plugin on PC or Mac, or maybe even Linux, because that's what we use on desktop, right? So he didn't have that granular control, but still, he was not the one making the list. So, for example, the ad network that's on his own blog was actually blocked by his own app because it was in the database that Ghostery uses. So those that are making their own lists, I think it's even worse. You know, you have the same situation, but you're just deciding. I mean, what if you had you just made like an anti-malware software of some kind, like AV and anti-spyware or whatever, and you just decided that, oh yeah, whatever gets bundled with that app, like, even though it does this and that, it's not really spyware because they're nice guys,
right?
Like, how would we react to that?
So you touched on something interesting there, talking about malware and stuff like that. Is that, you know, these is ad blockers don't, and I think you're right in your comment earlier where you call them content blockers. You know, they don't necessarily just stop ads. An example being September 22nd, CSO Online wrote a story about a blog post that had been written over at FireEye, where they were finding malvertising, right? Malware embedded in advertisements over on Forbes. I believe somebody else hit Realtor.com, the Drudge Report, eBay. Basically, all over this past month, we've seen a lot of ads that contained malware.
And that's something that's recurring, right? I mean, it's not the first time we see that. It's not going to be the last time for sure. And that's not very scientific data. Like, I don't have a I don't have enough data to call this scientific, but I can tell you that I've seen in the past, you know, think of an enterprise network where you might not have the best browser, you might not have the best version of Java and Flash, or you may have the worst of all these three. I'm sure you've seen that in the past. So imagine this totally like badly managed environment where you're missing so many updates. The typical kind of browser where you're just going to get infected by malware by just visiting anything. I've seen places where just by blocking ads, they've reduced the like low-end non-targeted malware detections by like close to 40%.
Wow.
You know, on let's say close to, let's say, 100 PCs, you reduce that by 40%. That's a lot of bandwidth. That's a lot of malware you don't have to deal with. You know, of course, probably not loading Java on any websites would, you know, be a much better security control than that. But still, just by blocking ads, they were able to do that. And companies typically do that at the network level, right? They just, you know, use whatever proxy they have and just block that that category. And it does have a good impact on security, but also privacy, and that you're not going to see that, right? It's not easy for you to know, you know, how many people have all the information they need to know, you know, what did you look at on a website? What did you click? Where did you come from? Are you the same person visiting these 25 different websites? You know, when I load a website and I see that I've connected to like 38 domains, that's a little bit crazy. But the crazy thing is, if you run any app on iOS, pretty much the same thing happens. So you got content blockers for websites now in iOS, but you don't have that for actual applications in the App Store, right? And right. There's so many app analytics platforms. So a similar kind of privacy problem is happening with the app. So I think in some cases, if you have to choose between the mobile app and just hitting the website with content blocking, you're probably better off using the website. So that's a bit kind of ironic that now, you know, using Safari in some cases is better than using the apps that might be in the App Store. But, you know, of course, Apple is never going to start filtering the things that the apps in the App Store are going to do. I mean, if they could do that, they would just reject the apps outright.
Now, so, to be fair, what is it? Safari Web Controller or something like that. Basically, a new framework allows apps to actually call the Safari browser inside, and that does actually allow content blocking. So to put you on the spot,
faster and
to put you on the spot real quick, what content blockers are you using on your Mac, in your browser on your desktop?
It's uBlock, but not uBlock, the one uBlock Plus or something else.
Okay. Are you using Ghostery at all or no?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
So I use uBlock Origin. The reason I use that one is it seems pretty fast, pretty efficient with memory, and it supports AdBlock formatted lists. Because I use some ad block lists for you know, French websites and things like that, so kind of customized. So I use that, and kind of like Ghostery, it does show you know, what did it block, what it allowed, and it lets you create, you know, whitelists either per website you're visiting or a specific ad network if you want. So that's what I use in Chrome, and that's what I use in Safari as well when I execute that by mistake.
And now, have you, because you mentioned doing a lot of testing, and I'll also link a guy named Ben Brooks over at the Brooks Review did a really comprehensive review and rundown of a bunch of iOS content blockers. Did you settle on one?
No, I haven't yet. I think what I have enabled on my phone right now is Blocker, with Blocker just CKR. And it felt like the list was pretty good, but it's not very customizable. One blocker seems to be the most customizable one that I've tried. There's a lot of options in there, and for some reason I don't enjoy creating lists manually on my phone. Maybe it's going to be different if I have it on iPad eventually, and I just create a big list and I can sync it. So I haven't really decided on one. I still have Peace installed, so I can also use that for now. And what I liked with piece was the extension where you could actually send a link to it. So if you're, let's say, in your RSS reader that doesn't support the new WebKit view, whatever you referred to earlier, you can just send a link to piece, and then it's going to open in a page. It's just going to overlay your app, and then the content blocking is going to be active. So I think that was pretty cool, and I haven't seen that in the other ad blockers yet.
But we know it's just a matter of time until somebody grabs it.
Yeah, and I was actually surprised. I thought there would have been more of them. Like, I actually expected guys like Adblock and uBlock and even Ghostery themselves to make one and be there on day one. So I don't really know why they're not there. Is it because, you know, they know there's not a whole lot of money in there? Or is it because, like, their business model doesn't fit it? Or it's just going to be later? I don't know. But I was surprised that, like, the entire list of ad blockers for iOS 9, like, I could actually install all of them without spending more than like $25 or something like that.
Right on. All right. So switching gears a little bit, because we have a few more minutes left, and we did have a couple of quick stories that popped out of my list. The first one I want to bring attention to is a post that was over on Ars Technica on the 21st. That states that the DHS InfoSec chief says that we should pull clearance of feds who fail phishing tests. Repeat offenders, quote, should not be holding a TSSCI with the federal government. This is interesting, and I think that I saw a reaction blog post go out from somebody in the community, but I don't remember who, unfortunately. But so basically, you know, the government does a lot of phishing tests. They're actually pretty big fans of them. As it stands right now, those who fail a phishing test are generally required to either take a security refresher class or might be publicly called out for errors. But the DHS CISO, Paul Beckman, said during a panel discussion that he believes it's time to ban those who flunk phishing 101 from having access to sensitive government data by revoking their clearances. Quote, someone who fails every single phishing campaign in the world should not be holding a TSSCI with the federal government. You have clearly demonstrated that you are not responsible enough to responsibly handle that information. Wow, that's harsh. I kind of agree and I kind of disagree. Like we were kind of talking about pre-show, this is a really harsh way of dealing with phishing tests, but at the same time, you're also dealing with sensitive data. I don't know, Guillaume, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, so the first thing is most of the articles that you see, the title is not exactly what the quote is. So if you look at, let's say on ours, you know, they say DHS InfoSec chief, we should pull clearance of feds who fail phish test. And that's all it says. But then the quote in the article is someone who fails every single phishing campaign in the world. So
yeah, that's pretty different.
Yeah, I think there's a difference here, because definitely if you fail like one phishing test, I think anyone can fail at one phishing test, especially if it's well targeted. I mean, if you get more and more and more and more information on me, eventually I'm going to fall for it. I mean, if you knew that Joseph was going to call me on Skype like 32 minutes ago and you just called me from a different Skype account called Joseph something else, I might have picked up the call, right?
Right.
It's just how much information do you have on that person? So I think if we're going to say you failed one phishing test, you lose your clearance. Well, first of all, that's pretty harsh. But then second, there needs to be people working there. So I think it would not be a really good idea from a HR perspective, because they're probably going to have to hire like more people every year. So that wouldn't make much sense. Now, I think if what he meant was, if you've shown that you'll fail these over and over and over, and then you take the training and you still fail, and if that's what he meant by if you fail every test in the world, then I think maybe he does have a point, right? You have access to sensitive information, you've been granted access to that, and you're showing that you're not responsible enough to handle that that kind of information. Now, so I think it all depends on what did he really mean by every single phishing campaign in the world, because I'm sure he didn't mean like every single phishing campaign in the world, because that's a lot of phishing. Like, you would have to be very efficient to fail at every single phishing campaign in the world.
It's like a full-time job.
So I think we should take it with a grain of salt. I think what he meant was like repeat failure and after training and all that. If that's it, then I think I agree with it. But if it's just after like you failed once, you're out, well, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot, because the person who just failed once, after they take training, they're probably going to be more sensitive to phishing, you know? Mm-hmm. So more than the person who hasn't failed yet, right? And who just got hired because the person who failed once was fired. So I think it's to be taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I totally agree there. The title was just too fun to not discuss. But I think you definitely make a good point. And then I guess to round out, Guillaume, have you ever thought, man, I thought IPS was a really great thing and I really want it for my home personal network?
Well, I have, but you have to consider what my job is. So for us, it's just like, hey, like, let's play with some toys, see how they work, what they block, what they fail at. But I don't think it's a normal thing to think about. And I surely wouldn't want to be, you know, managing IPSs for my friends and family on their home.
So a device has, there's an Indiegogo campaign for a quote, it's an Internet of Things cyber criminal stopper device. You know, so it's called Cujo. And basically, the idea is that you plug it into your network and it does. I'm trying to find some details on how this works. But it monitors all your connected devices, it protects against hackers, viruses, malware, and dangerous sites with firewalls and antivirus, and then uses machine learning to analyze when something seems amiss. It's a cute little box. It only costs $50, but then you pay $100 or $90 a year for a subscription. You know, we talk a lot about the Internet of Things, and we talk about a lot about, you know, putting all of these devices online. This is actually not a bad idea. I think the execution is going to be difficult, and I haven't looked enough into this particular solution. But this actually seems like kind of an interesting idea. What do you think?
Well, is it for Internet of Things or just everything on your network, right? I think it would also help with, you know, any kind of PC or mobile device that is connected to your Wi-Fi. Just, you know, it blocks stuff at the network layer. It does seem like from the website, it seems pretty similar to, you know, it's basically a small office, you know, UTM kind of device that has some definitions for malware and has some rules and blocks traffic and probably will block some known attacks. And because they're targeting Internet of Things, maybe they're going to make, you know, definitions specifically for, let's say, whatever thermostat that you might have or whatever. Where I think it might be a good product where I don't think it's, first of all, I think it should be integrated in a Wi-Fi router. One thing that I would like to see someone come up with would be a, you know, consumer wireless network router all integrated with some security features. But I think one of these security features should just be by default, we don't just have like your main SSID and maybe a guest SSID, but maybe we also have a Internet of Things SSID where every device is isolated from every other device and cannot talk to your home network and only talk to the internet, because that's one of the things, right? Right? Everyone is afraid of one of these devices being owned and then being used to attack everything else that's in your house. So I think network segmentation would be a good thing here. There's a lot of wireless issues, like, you know, those light bulbs, I forget the brand, but those that were just basically broadcasting your Wi-Fi password, you know which ones I'm referring to, right?
Not off the top of my head.
All right. I think I remember which one it is. I just don't want to say it because I'm not 100% sure and I wouldn't want to, you know, blame the wrong company. But basically, you had light bulbs where there's a bridge device and there's one of the light bulbs is connected to your Wi-Fi and there's some kind of RF broadcasting between that light bulb and the other ones. And it was just broadcasting your Wi-Fi password, you know, barely encrypted or encoded. And someone could just sniff that with Wireshark or whatever, then get on your Wi-Fi network. That's not something that any device that's sitting between your cable modem and your router or your router and your internal network is going to be able to stop, first of all, because it's just a Wi-Fi problem. But having a separate Wi-Fi network for those would definitely help, because then if someone did that, then maybe they can, you know, steal your internet connection, but they can't, you know, scan your networks, your PCs, and all of that. So I think it's an interesting product. I just don't think it should have to exist. Yeah. I don't think, you know, malware, and like, I don't think having AV on your network to protect your thermostat, like, what world do we live in where that even sounds like a product idea? Like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, I would much rather see people make secure devices and secure software. Obviously, they're not doing that. So people are going to try to sell, you know, products that go around that. But for me personally,
It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah. How many Wi-Fi networks do you have in your house?
Me? One, but possibly two, depending on how Comcast feels that day and whether or not they're ignoring that little option.
Right. So if you have one of these devices that leaked your Wi-Fi password, that could be a problem. If one of them had a botnet on it, it would then be able to scan your entire network and get to you. And I think, you know, telling the average consumer, oh, it'll just create like different VLANs and different SSIDs and blah, 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 that really doesn't work. But I think if you're a big consumer brand, I think it would be pretty doable to make a all-in-one thing that's got, you know, different Wi-Fi connection completely for your Internet of Things. And you just tell people, you know, give it a name. So you go, you know, name, and then you get name underscore guess and name underscore IoT or name underscore things or whatever you feel is less stupid at the time of generating the name. And then people could use that. It would be pretty user-friendly. And you could even do things like, oh, let's generate passwords that are, you know, more user-friendly to type on a thermostat because it's the IoT one. So let's just use like really long passwords, but maybe not special characters because switching keyboards there is terrible and all that. So there could be some interesting features in there, but I think it has to come from one of the big consumer brands. Plus, I don't think people really buy that stuff, right? When you go to Best Buy, you see all these, you know, Wi-Fi access points and routers and all of that. I feel like it's kind of like TiVo and DVR where people just use whatever they get from their internet provider. Mm-hmm. If your internet provider gives you all-in-one modem, router, Wi-Fi, sometimes people even pay to lease that and then they pay more to get the faster Wi-Fi or whatever. So I really don't think people are going to be rushing to buy that. It's not going to be like a big consumer thing. But if one of these devices that's distributed by internet service providers included something like, you know, default network segmentation for these types of devices, I think that would be really, really interesting. I remember seeing a really similar product maybe in 2009, 2010. It was a company from, I think it was Israel, and it was called a Yogi. And I think they're bankrupt now. It didn't work out. But the idea was, it was basically a Linux computer with, I think it was MIPS processor back then. Basically, what they made would have worked super well on a Raspberry Pi if it existed. And the way it worked is, you would just plug that in between your laptop and your network, like your Ethernet connection. Or if you were on Wi-Fi, then they would just have some Wi-Fi driver in Windows that would redirect the traffic to that. And it was just like a small Linux box with like Snort installed, some antivirus, like a proxy thing with a blacklist to block, you know, known malicious networks and things like that. And it was actually pretty useful. It was a little slow considering the CPUs of that time. So that seems to be a really similar product. And maybe now they're going to sell enough of them that it's going to be sustainable. But I really don't think, you know, I don't think Oprah is going to be giving them out and people are going to be freaking over it. I hope it works out for them. But I think for security in general, better devices would be better and better software.
Yeah. Well, Guillaume, with that, I think we're actually over our time. So I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. Guillaume, thank you so much for joining me tonight. If people wanted to get in touch with you or read your writings or something along those lines, what might be a way that they could find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Geppetto42 with just one P and one T, even though I know that's not how it's supposed to be written. Or you can find me on binaryfactory.ca, and my email address and everything is in there.
Fantastic. Show notes for this week's episode can be found at southernfriedsecurity.com/167. You can always get in touch with us via the Southern Fried Security Twitter account at SFSPodcast. And you can find me at Jay Sicoli on Twitter. And with that, we'll talk to you later.